So we're putting our money where our mouth is because we don't make money on a retainer. We make money on what we call a success fee. So when the deal closes, we get a percentage fee of the deal, and that fee generally is escalated based on the valuation. So we set up a valuation par,
okay,
which is like the baseline based on valuation concepts of where we would get paid, and you get paid a base fee up to that point. And then for every dollar above that base fee in a premium, you get paid kind of a bonus catch.
All right, so today our guest is a guy named Dwayne Donner. So I've had the privilege of knowing Dwayne for probably the last 4 or 5 years, really, really involved in Highlands College and Church of Highlands, but his main business is a business called Founders Advisors. Dwayne is really passionate about business, but his next level passion and his desire is ministry in the workplace. So they've got a new ministry called Abide and Lead, and he's got a new podcast that we're going to discuss. So my guest today is Dwayne Donner. Dwayne, thanks for being here.
Yeah, thank you for having me, Thomas.
You're so welcome. The thing that you're from Louisiana,
right?
But really, like, you've been here longer than you have been in Birmingham, longer than you have been in, we're in Louisiana, correct?
Yes, close. Yes,
pretty close. Pretty okay, close. So let's talk business first. Your business journey. Tell me what you've built and led, and start from after college.
Yeah, well, it's a pretty unconventional track I took. Of course, grew up in Louisiana, very entrepreneurial area during the oil boom. I went to college, started at LSU. I'm a Tigers fan.
That's right.
I actually got my undergrad. I finished up at, it's now the University of Louisiana.
Lafayette. It's really Louisiana Lafayette.
Yeah,
let's
Raging
just get
Cajuns.
It right. Yeah, the Cajuns.
Raging Cajuns, so yeah. I'm a Cajun. Got a degree in engineering. Went to work at the time for an oil field service company, Global Industries, which was my father-in-law's business, and Bill Dore. And he was building this company. And, of course, at the time, back in the early 90s, there weren't many job opportunities, and offered me a job. I went to work for them, had a great experience there, learned a lot. It was during a very challenging time in the oil and gas industry, and went through a whole series of events. Very interesting story. The company almost went bankrupt.
Really?
But by the grace of God and a hurricane.
Amen.
A hurricane.
Thanks God for natural disasters.
Yeah, natural disaster. We saw the company go from the verge of bankruptcy to a turnaround that was like unprecedented in the history of the business.
So why did a hurricane help you? To explain that.
Yeah, just real quickly on that, because it's a long story, but his business was an offshore construction company where they laid pipelines and set big structures,
in the ocean.
In the Gulf of Mexico.
Gulf of America.
Gulf of America, I'm sorry.
Okay.
Gulf of America. It used to be the Gulf of Mexico.
That's
And he had kind of predicted this, that we were going to have a hurricane. Of course, we were like, what are you talking about?
Yeah.
But this hurricane, it was Hurricane Andrew, which he calls St. Andrew.
That was a massive
massive hurricane. Came into the Gulf of Mexico and essentially tore up just miles, and I mean hundreds of miles of pipelines and offshore platforms.
Wow.
And his business was just perfectly positioned to do all the repair and construction, basically maintenance and all that for that.
Wow.
And he leveraged it, and basically the company went from, again, basically the doorstep of bankruptcy to it turned into a flourishing business. Right on the heels of that, he hired some investment bankers, which I didn't even know what an investment banker was.
Sure.
And he actually took the company public. And I got to watch all that happen. And it was like fascinating to me and really planted the seed for this concept of investment banking in me way back then. So
wow.
I went on from there. I got my MBA. I actually came to Alabama, got my MBA in Alabama.
So why did you come to Birmingham?
Yeah, I know. People always ask me that. It's kind of fascinating. Well, I went to Tuscaloosa first, which was arch rival of
not really.
LSU Tigers. And the main reason I went to Alabama was my wife, who we were married at the time. I'd spent some time in the military. I went through Officer Canada School. And actually got put on active duty during Desert Storm. That's a whole other story.
Dude, I've known you 5 years and never known this.
Yeah, yeah.
That's
so
awesome.
I did that. I got married when I was in the Army on active duty. When I got out, went to work for my father-in-law. Then my wife had gone to Alabama, so we had some relationships here. Alabama was an up-and-coming MBA school. They offered me a fellowship. So I came to Alabama, got my MBA. Had two kids at the time.
Oh, wow.
Well, I got my MBA. And then I launched a business. My first entrepreneurial business. I'm very entrepreneurial. Always wanted to have my own business. My first entrepreneurial business, which was a, believe it or not, it was a Cajun food business.
Amen. There you go.
Called Creole's Market. And I had a passion. I still have a passion for cooking, for food, for hospitality. So I launched that business. Look, you know, hey, sure. There you go. And, you know, this is one of the life lessons. I was very ambitious. I knew nothing about the food business.
Yeah.
But I jumped into it. It grew very rapidly, and I was overly ambitious. At the time, really wasn't in my walk with the Lord. I mean, I had a faith. I'd, you know, go, kind of going to church, but I really wasn't connected to the
sure.
Lord. And I made a bunch of very aggressive moves. Bought a USDA plant in Atlanta against my wife's better judgment. And about 3 or 4 years later, found out, and this is relevant for you since you're, yeah. I know your things about how to build a company and stay healthy.
Yeah.
Well, I did the opposite. Mm. And basically woke up 4 years into this business, almost bankrupt financially, bankrupt in my marriage, in my relationships, health. I got rushed to the hospital, thought I had a heart attack. But what I found out, which I was so bizarre, is I had an anxiety attack and really left me in this terrible place.
How old were you at the time?
I was 29.
Oh, my stars.
Yeah. And so my wife did kind of the best and worst thing, you know, of my life. She basically gave me an ultimatum and said, you're either going to sell this business or get out. I don't care what you do. Or, you know, I'm taking, and we had never talked about divorce or anything.
Sure.
We grew up Catholic, so you don't do that. But she said, I'm taking the kids and it's over. And I'm like, you can't do that. And she goes, well, and my wife's a very mild mannered woman.
Yeah.
But she gave me, so I had a choice, you know, either, you know, this business that was killing me or, you know, my family. And it was one of the most painful things I've ever done. I had to go through an exit process in that business, which was very painful and very much humbling and hurt my pride and really kind of had to start over from there. So that was, and so that led to a series of events that got me into investment banking in my early 30s, working for a firm here.
Mm.
I did some deals, found it was a love and passion. During that time, I got born again. Early in the days of the Church of the Highlands, Pastor Chris.
So you were here at the beginning days. So Church of the Highlands is where we're shooting this. One of our campuses is Grandview campus. This is the campus of Highlands College. Passion of Pastor Chris is wonderful, wonderful place. You and I both are extremely involved in this place.
Absolutely.
So you were here during the Mountain Brook days.
Yes. In fact, I think it was 3 or 4 months after the church started. I got invited to a Bible study at a guy's house, Richard Randolph. Of course, Hamp Green is my brother-in-law, and he and Colette had really had a life-changing experience, and I observed this and went to this Bible study, and Chris Hodges was doing a little series on life purpose, and I wanted to know my life purpose.
That's good.
I was just dying to know my life purpose. At the time, I was, I think, you know, 32, 33. And he said, hey, if you want to know your life purpose, you really just, it's simple.
Okay.
You have to surrender your life to the Lord and you, because he created you for a purpose.
Absolutely.
And then he'll show you what your purpose is when you get aligned with him, Ephesians 2:10. And I was like, okay.
I'm in.
And I said, yes. And I'm telling you, it was a life changing. I didn't understand this whole concept of like being born again, and everybody has a different experience.
Well, being raised Catholic, that was probably a hard concept to
totally
understand.
A hard concept.
Yeah.
But it really happened to me. My whole life was changed, my whole view of everything. And it really set me on a path towards health.
Sure.
Across the board, the things you talk about, because I started seeing everything differently.
Yeah.
I saw business as not a means to an end to where I go make a living and, you know, get all these things, but more of it's a platform for life and ministry. Really, it's really our platform for how we go use our gifts.
Right.
And I started to understand my purpose. And then shortly thereafter, I had the opportunity to start Founders Advisors.
Okay.
And I was very hesitant to do that because I'd been through this very dark, you know, entrepreneurial endeavor. My wife was, you know, not real confident in my
abilities. You were working for an investment company.
I was working for a large CPA firm, and I was doing M&A advisory investment banking within that firm.
M&A advisory. Mergers and acquisition advisory. Yeah. So you were helping people buy and sell businesses.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
At this firm.
Within this firm.
Within the firm. So you were an employee.
I was an employee kind of building a business within their firm.
Okay.
In fact, I was working with, you may know, a guy named Ken Polk.
Yeah.
Ken would be a great guy for you to get on this show if you haven't. He's really, so anyway, Ken and I were working together during that time.
So you leave the investment firm and start Founders.
Yes.
First question is, tell me how Founders got started. Did you just leave this and start this? So how do you start something like that?
Well, one thing is I learned a lesson in my first entrepreneur endeavor.
What was that?
And to the audience, you know, the big lesson I tell everybody, all these young entrepreneurs that come to me and like, I say, look, the first thing, man, is you don't know what you don't know. Mm. So no matter how smart, ambitious, you have to understand, like, there's a whole world of knowledge and experience out there that will help you be successful. So the main thing I learned was to go do something, no matter how smart and passionate you are, it's best if you go learn about the thing and get some degree of understanding of the business and industry. Otherwise, you're really just walking in the dark. And so I learned that through the school of hard knocks. So that's why when I went into investment banking, I ultimately wanted to have my own firm, but I worked in it for, you know, several years, and I learned about the business, and I got a track record, and I learned, hey, am I good at this? And I started getting some positive affirmations, and then the right time came, and it was a series of events that happened. Always knew ultimately I was going to do it, but I didn't know the timing. But then in 2003,
okay,
after a lot of things happened in our economy, they came across with this Sarbanes-Oxley, which basically said, at Sarbanes-Oxley said that you couldn't, but essentially, I worked for an accounting firm. You couldn't cross, you know, services. So a lot of the clients I was working with were clients of our CPA firm.
Okay.
And so they basically said the advantages of being part of this CPA firm are no longer. So it gave me a perfect way to say, hey, well, I appreciate it, but I'm going to go
start my own thing.
And Ken Polk did the same thing. He started his firm at the same time. We were both working there. And it just opened it. But I will tell you, it was a scary time, and I was a new believer, and I really, there was a lot of prayer, and I started Founders with a whole different heart and mindset, totally opposite of the way I started my first business.
So you start Founders Advisors, you're a new believer. Was there a spiritual tilt of like, how can I help people and how can I help the kingdom, but also be great at business?
Absolutely. And so what happened is the best way for me to explain it is like this regeneration of my life. What happens is it reprogrammed my brain in an instant, which is like a miraculous thing. And so I went from a model that we typically have, and I was trained in through business school and the military, where like, I'm going to go get my piece of the pie. It's kind of a zero sum game. It's kind of a scarcity concept to in an instant. I started seeing that, no, God, again, through this concept of purpose, has given me a set of gifts. He's got, there's plenty. There's abundance. It's not a zero-sum game. There's a win-win in everything we do. And it just changed the whole way I thought about everything, the way I saw people, the way I saw, you know, everything. So I really, when I started Founders, I had a whole different view, and it really more of a stewardship concept.
Sure.
I'm not doing this because it's mine. It's really more, God's given me this opportunity to start this business and to use the business really as an expression of my gifts to add value and to bless people and to really do what God's called me to do and to build. And in fact, there was a conversation I had with Pastor Chris way back in the day. It was like probably a week or two after I had this kind of revelation.
Yeah.
And I went and had lunch with him at P.F. Chang's, one of his favorite
spots. That's right. He talked about it Sunday.
And we were having lunch, and I'm like, man, I was just like, dude, Chris, you're not going to believe this, but like, I mean, I got born again. He goes, well, good, man. That's what we do, man.
That's the goal.
And he was like, what you gonna? I said, no, I think I'm going to, you know, I'm thinking about going into full-time ministry. And, you know, I've kind of talked to my wife about that, and she was like, I don't know about all this.
I don't know about
She was really trying to take it all in. And he said, well, why would you do that? And I said, well, I don't know. I mean, I'm excited about what God's doing. And he goes, well, what do you do? And I told him, and he said, well, do you enjoy what you do? And I'm like, yeah. And he said, well, you know, your business can be kind of a platform for you to do ministry. In fact, you can have relationships and reach people we probably can't reach.
Yeah.
And that was the first time I'd ever really heard that.
Yeah.
And it really resonated with me and got me super excited.
Right.
Because I was going like, you know, I was kind of like, well, I'll go into ministry, but wasn't real excited because I didn't even know what that meant.
Didn't know what that meant.
But really that changed. And that's kind of led me to operating in this different mode. And it really, I think I was pretty good at business before because I'm just hard charging and, you know, but I think it took me to another level because people, there was a lot of heart in what I was doing and a lot of passion. And it was really rooted in, you know, the love of God. Like, I want to go help and love people. I'm not just trying to go get my thing.
Make a dollar.
Know? Make a dollar or get my piece of the pie. So, and when I started Founders, I was probably about a year and a half, 2 years into that journey. And I did it with open hands. I remember, like, I literally was like, God, you know. And my wife was very reticent to turn me loose. Yeah. And so she laid down the law.
That's right.
You know, and, so, and of course, it was scary. And there was a lot of prayer, but we started the company, and it was a risky deal because I had one. The way I started was I basically was doing the business and then separated from this firm. I had one marginal deal and not a lot of capital, and I just had a lot of faith. And I believe, you know, I really felt like God was leading me, and I started the business with a lot of faith. But this time I knew what I was doing. I mean, I knew what I was doing.
Okay, so you've mentioned gifts about four times in the first 15 minutes we've been talking. Yeah. What are your one or two gifts?
Yeah, I mean, I think my innate gifts are I really enjoy people, relationships. I love helping people. I have the gift of hospitality. Mm. Like, that's part of my culture. We love hosting, and it's part of what all the ministry I've done over the years. I think what some of my gifts that I've kind of learned through a lot of my experience is I'm very process minded and I'm disciplined. So, you know, you take kind of the people hospitality thing, and you combine it with, you know, the process driven, and I have some, you know, I got educated, learned some things, and I have kind of an engineering process thinking, and then, you know, you put on top of that like a passion, like God's called me to do this, and it was just a good combo because it gives you a lot of momentum,
right?
You know.
Founders Advisors, tell me, because I'm going to be honest with you, when people ask me, I give a loose answer about what is Founders.
No, and most people do. Right?
So tell me, what exactly does Founders Advisors do?
At a high level, we're in the business of helping owners and, you know, business owners and founders go through the transition process of their companies. That's really what we do. And we mainly, you know, execute that service through them because they own companies, helping them with some type of transition or exit process. Most of the time that is a sale
Correct.
Of some or all of their company. And most of the time it is to a third party, a strategic buyer, a public company, a private equity. But we're as this has evolved and we've grown into this, there's more options and opportunities in this. Sometimes it can be a sale to your employees through an ESOP. It can be a sale to your employees through more of an internal, longer-term transition, which is actually what we're doing at Founders. So it's really, we're all going to go through a transition.
All of us.
It's just a matter of when, and are you going to literally be proactive and sitting at the table and doing it in a way that optimizes it, or are you going to be reactive, which many people are. And that's a lot of it, where they just wait because they don't spend time preparing or thinking about it. And then they wake up, they're 70 years old, they got health issues, and it's like, now I have to go do it. And normally that's not the best outcome.
Sure.
In many ways.
Don't say names because I know you can't. Give me an example of a deal that you've done the last year. Like walk me through that.
Yeah, well, we're doing about, you know, 40 a year right now, so there's a lot going on. But I mean, there's so many case studies, but one that comes to mind that's recent, and it was just a perfect solution that, you know, and again, they don't always work out perfectly.
Oh, no question. Yeah.
but we have a good batting average.
Yeah.
And but this particular company is they have a presence here, but they have you know, a big presence in Texas. They came to us, had amazing business that had been building for 30 years, family business. I knew these people very well.
Can you tell me the industry?
I'd prefer not to.
Okay, yeah, go ahead.
Because you probably would figure it out if I told
pretty
you.
Quickly.
and they're amazing people. But they came to us and said, look, we have this company we've been building. Our kids are now coming into our business. Mm. The kids were just getting out of college. Daughter was married. And they said, we love what we do, but we're getting older. They were in their 60s. And we don't want to keep running at the pace we're running at. We have an east and a west part of our business.
Okay.
And we want to do a deal. And their industry was very hot. It was perfect timing. And we had been talking to him for years on how to position their business, and it was very well positioned. So we essentially went out and helped them break their company into two pieces, an east and west. And we took their western division, which was our largest division of their business, and we brought it to market, found the perfect strategic partner who was already in the industry.
When you say strategic partner, what do you mean?
I mean, strategic partner generally means somebody who's in your business or in some, you know, dimension of your market or industry, where when you put your business with their business, there's a synergy.
Sure.
That's realized. A financial buyer is just somebody that's buying your company.
Just got cash.
Because they think you can get a good return or grow it. A strategic buyer actually brings something to the table other than money. This particular company was in their industry, but not in their market. Their big market was Texas. They owned Texas. And so this company brought to bear a lot of technology and systems and things that they really needed in their business. But also, because of that, they were able to pay a very high value for their business and make a win-win deal. Because you always want the deal to be a win-win, right? It's got to be 1 + 1 = more than 2. And so that we were able to sell off their Texas division for a very large sum of money in the hundreds of millions. And they were able to cut, we were able to cut the deal where they could still maintain and grow their Eastern division, bring their family into the business. But they had basically taken most of the chips or the biggest chips off the table. So now they could do this business, and even if their kids fail, they still win.
Sure.
You follow me? Whereas if they were to put the whole business at risk with their kids, they could have lost, you know, a major 30 years of value.
So they sold the Texas division. Are the kids going to take over
So they're mentoring their kids into taking over their Eastern division, and that's going to be their next generation's opportunity to create their own, you know, business and wealth with a little head start. So that's an example.
That's great.
And so we walked them from A to Z through that whole process. It's a very involved process that took us, you know, probably 10 months. And there's a lot to all that. And from the beginning of just assessing it, helping them understand what the market is and the opportunity, and then taking them through to execute that process.
So if I'm wrong, just say, hey, no, that's not right, Thomas. Okay. So you're in essence kind of like a real estate agent, meaning you find the buyer, you have the company, you find the buyer, and you put the two together, but you do a lot more than just an agent. Like, you're helping the due diligence part of it.
There's one piece to that that's true, that we are, and you know, helping put the deal together. I think the difference between investment banking and, let's call it, a broker, is that an investment banker or an advisor, what we do is we literally underwrite the business. So like a piece of real estate, you kind of know what the, in this case, just so you understand, in most of our business deals, in this case, we had valuations, you know, that were ranging from 6x their EBITDA to, you know, 11x their EBITDA. And that variation, because they had a large EBITDA, is literally tens of millions.
Right.
And so one is, you have to, on the front end, advise them on timing and a lot of things, because the market's very dynamic and there's a lot of variables. The second thing is, we make a market. So opposed to like you just listed on MLS or whatever, and you know, we literally proactively run a process where we identify all these suitors, both strategic and financial, and we drive through a process to get to like the actual deal. Whereas on, like in that case, we probably had, I think, 10 or 12 offers. And then from those offers, you down select to have management meetings, and then you negotiate. So it's a much more in depth and complicated process, where you make a market opposed to you just put listed on a market.
Right. How do you make money? How does Founders Advisors make money in that deal?
Yeah, the way we make money is we get paid a fee. Generally, we get paid a retainer fee, which is a small portion of what we do, which is a commitment fee for us being hired to do this. So there's a lot of work that goes into that.
I can only imagine.
And if the deal doesn't close, we lose big time. So we're putting our money where our mouth is, because we don't make money on a retainer. We make money on what we call a success fee. So when the deal closes, we get a percentage fee of the deal, And that fee generally is escalated based on the valuation. So we set up a valuation par,
okay,
which is like the baseline based on valuation concepts of where we would get paid. And you get paid a base fee up to that point. And then for every dollar above that base fee in a premium, you get paid kind of a bonus kicker. So we're very incented for the incremental dollars.
To get them more dollars. So let me give you an example. Let me talk this out. So you put a base fee of $1 million. Let's just use an easy number. $1 million. We think it could sell for $1 million. If it sells for two, you get extra on top of that.
Yeah, well, let me put it to you this way.
Yeah.
Because I like your example, except for you said you have a base fee of $1 million. If it sells for $1 million, that means, let me put it to you this way. So you have a company. And if they took the company to market like the one I just talked about, in fact, they already had some offers.
Before they got you.
Before they got us. And those offers were in kind of the $150 million.
Okay.
Range. And we said your company's worth, we think your company's worth close to $200 million.
Okay.
Okay. And if we sell your company for $200 million, you're going to pay us $2 million.
Right.
Let's just say. And that wasn't the numbers, but that's
sure. True. Good. Yeah.
But we think if we do what we think we can do, we think we can sell your company probably for $230 to maybe up to $250 million.
Okay.
And if we sell your company for $250 million, you pay us, you know, 1% up to $200 million. But for everything over $200 million, which is, let's call that the par,
yeah,
that you're going to pay us maybe 4% on the incremental. So if we get you $250 million, then we're going to make, you know, an extra $2 million bucks.
So $200 million, let's just, the par is $200 million, you make your 1%. But on the $50 million, if you sell it for $250, you make 4% on the $50
million. That's right.
That motivates you guys.
So
that's great.
So the bottom line, whereas most real estate agents, they're just trying to get the deal done.
Get the fee.
A good investment banker knows I can go create value through the process.
Sure.
Finding the right people, selling the right points. Because by the way, we're selling this to investors.
Right.
So we're not, it's just not a commodity. And we have to convince and show them how they're going to get their return and show them the synergy.
So you're working, I hate to say four, but you're kind of working for both sides.
No, we're working for our client exclusively. So we're 100% for them, but we're equipping the buyer who thinks way different than our client.
Sure.
They're thinking, because they're investors. We're giving them what they need to go to their investment committees to make the case for why I can pay an extra $40 million for this. Now, in their mind, it's not an extra $40 million. Mm. It's just the price of the business.
The price.
But that's what I'm saying. It's a way different than the way a real estate deal may be done.
That's a wonderful example. So when these companies are scaling, what separates a companies that scale well from the ones that like stall out? What's the difference in the twos that really grow and that don't grow?
Yeah, well? That was one of the questions I know that you had laid out there, and I thought about that a lot. And again, there's a lot of variations to this. I would say timing is such a big deal in business. And again, if you've never been through a business, you don't understand timing.
I don't understand it.
But I know like in our own business, there was a point in time where I realized, now again, I probably should have realized a little earlier, but I realized there was no way I was going to be able to scale our business to the next level unless I made the investment and brought in the right people, the right leaders, the right team to do it. And people fool themselves and they think, well, I'm an entrepreneur, I can do anything. No, you can't. And really, you got to bring in people, one, who have the skill set, but also you have to bring in people that kind of understand and many times have a different skill set on what it means to scale something. And I know in our own case, in our business, we made that decision back in 2003 about whatever, no, no, 2013, I'm sorry. We started in 2003. About 10 years in, I knew I couldn't do it.
Mm.
And so I made a decision. I had some resources. Instead of putting the resources in my bank account, I'm going to invest back in this business,
right,
which it takes investment most of the time, and bring in some key people that can work on the business instead of in the business. That's a huge point right there.
Yeah,
huge. It's a huge point. Most people don't understand this.
It's hard.
Working in the business, being a producer, delivering is way different than working on the business. To scale, you have to work on the business.
What's the number one mistake business owners make when they're trying to sell their business?
They don't think about selling their business. They're not proactive. They're reactive. So they don't do the things and think forward and begin with the end in mind. And the beauty of this, if you do begin with the end in mind, and you do have a proactive approach to, like, one day I may sell my company, even if you don't sell your company, you have a way better company.
Because
the things that people value company, the things that make a company valuable are the things that make it less dependent on the owner and more a sustainable business that has less risk. And that's good for the owner if he decides to keep it. What happens lots of times, if people spend time really building their company for a sale, they decide they don't want to sell it because it's too good.
Well, because at that point, if you're building it for a sale, as the owner, you're not having to do as much. And it's kicking off whatever cash flow or whatever, you know, money for you as the owner. And if you sell it, that's gone.
Exactly. So you don't have that, you don't have that income coming in. I think what most people, and even smart people, fail to realize, because you start a company as a founder, you have to work very hard and you're doing a lot of different things. What most people don't realize, the more dependent the company is on you in any facet, the less valuable your company is.
Sure.
Because there's too much risk. And by the way, I don't care how good you are, one person can only do so much.
Only do so much. That's truly true. So you have, say you said 40 deals a year. 40 deals a year is what, on average. How many people come to you that you say, no, I can't help you?
More what we say, there are some. And
so I may have worded that wrong, but you understand my question.
That's a great question, because that's really a good M&A advisor, investment banking firm. They say no more than they say yes. And so what it is, we do, there are many, we get a lot of opportunities. We're getting probably per week, we're looking at, you know, 10, 20 opportunities per week. We have a lot of sources that are sending us deal flow, which is the key to our business, deal flow. And there are times when we say, man, this isn't a good fit. And most of the time that's because of the industry or the size or something that it just doesn't fit what we do. More often what we're saying is, hey, you got a good business and we are interested, but you're not ready. This is not the right time. What you need to do is you need to work on these things to get your business in a much better position. So when you go to market, one, you have a much higher probability of success. In other words, the worst thing that can happen for us or the client is you go through a market process and you're not successful. That's called sunk cost.
Where you said your company doesn't make money on the retainer.
No, we lose big time on that. And so does the client, because now there's a learning experience that's good. And many times what happens is we go to market, and this happens even in public markets. You go to take a company public and the market's not there, so you pull it back. You don't take it public. Now there's a cost to that. But then now you've kind of learned and it may go public 6 months later. We do that often. We take a company to market. We're not getting the interest that we hoped, because maybe the company's not performing, maybe the stock market's down. There's all kinds of variables that can happen outside of your control. And so then you might pull it back. But the best thing to do with a marginal business is to identify, what can I do to make this a highly investment-grade company? So when I do go to market, I've got way more interest.
Yeah.
And I have more competition, and that ensures that I'm going to get a deal done, and I'm going to get it done at a high valuation. And the final part of that most people don't understand in this world, is it's not just I go find a buyer and sell the company to the highest bidder, but it's also what's the right fit.
Sure.
Because that example I gave earlier about that deal we did with that family, the other part of that equation, which was so exciting to us and probably most exciting, not only did they pay the best price, and they brought a lot to the table, but the synergy and the chemistry between our owner and their leaders was there. Mm. And many times, if you don't have chemistry,
it's not going to succeed.
It creates a problem.
I know you've talked about timing. I mean, timing sounds like to me is critical in all of these things. What are one or two industries that do really well for you guys? I mean, they come to you and you.
Yeah, our you do biggest well. The biggest industry that we serve, and this is a big headline, is the industrial, you know, kind of industrial, and within that it's industrial services, industrial tech. This is where I run the company as CEO. I used to run our industrial practice. That practice has, I think, over 20 professionals in it, and probably accounts for 30-40% of our business.
Wow.
Within industrials, you go into a lot of subsectors. So we focus on sector coverage, meaning you have to understand your industry and the sectors within it. So we, all the way down to, like, I talked to a company yesterday working for that's an industrial maintenance company, and they basically go into plants and provide all these services, the cleaning services, chemical services. We have industrial tech, which is, you know, these are like different types of technologies that serve industrial companies, all the way to, like, you know, electrical grid companies that are servicing electrical grid. So within that, that's one of them. And the second one is tech. We do a lot of work in tech. Zane Torrance, my partner, built our tech practice. We do a lot of, you know, SaaS companies, yep, software companies. We do a lot of tech-enabled services. We do a lot of, you know, digital media.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah, businesses. So within technology, there's, you know, hundreds of subsectors. And so what we try to do is really go deep in some of these areas. And that's why I said there are certain areas that we don't maybe have the depth. And if somebody comes to us and says, hey, would you, we'd say, look, we're not probably the most experienced in that. You might want to talk to this group.
What are some industries you stay away from?
I think some of the industries we don't really, we refer people to, is like trucking and transportation. That's one. Real estate. We don't do deals in real estate. You know, we're not, you know, even real estate companies that kind of have operating companies, we generally stay away from that.
Okay.
And, you know, I mean, we've actually moved into insurance, so we're doing some deals in insurance. You know, there's some sectors within, we do healthcare, but there's some sectors within healthcare that we, you know, maybe stay away from, like biotech and stuff like that. So it just depends within the broader gamut.
Zane, you talked about Zane.
Yeah.
I don't know Zane real well. Zane's book that he wrote, I don't know, however many years ago. It's like a guide of, yeah, hey, if you want to sell your business, Zane Torrance, you can look at the book's on Amazon. If you want to sell
17 reasons why your company's not investment grade.
That's right. Okay. I've got it sitting on my shelf. It's a great book. So that book is kind of a blueprint, would you say,
yeah,
of like, hey, if you want to sell your company, these are the things, right?
Yeah, those are the main things. So yes, Zane did a great job with that. We've used that in our business. In fact, we've developed now an assessment that basically takes all that, and we've hired developers and put it into an algorithm that essentially a business owner in a particular sector, maybe they have a SaaS company or their industrial service or home services business, they can take that assessment, which takes about 20 minutes. We've had thousands of companies take it, and we're building a whole database of kind of benchmarks. But really, they take that assessment, and it really grades them,
okay,
on how market ready is their company, and then what are the two or three things that they need to focus on to really elevate their business from a market perspective in the context of those 17 main
things,
tenets that drive value in a business. And the reality is they're not all equal. I mean, there's some of them are much more value enhancers than others, but they all matter.
They all matter. But some of them are weighted back more.
Yeah, they're weighted much heavier.
Okay, so.
And this assessment goes to the weighting process.
So there's business owners watching this right now.
Yeah.
Okay. What advice would you give to a business owner that's trying to sell?
Well, I mean, I think the first thing is, you know, I do think it's very wise to have advisors who can come around you and help you understand how your company, you know, would be viewed by the market, what would be should be your expectation of valuation, and how marketable is your company? You
sure.
Because the truth is, there's a lot of good businesses that may have a hard time getting a good deal, selling, because they're just certain issues. Now, doesn't mean somebody won't buy it, but,
right?
You know. So I think the first thing is to understand, because like anything, again, you're in a business. I'm understanding at some level because I've been in it, but you know, people think, oh, the food business. Well, you just go in there and, you know, I know
make food, make food and take orders.
Yeah, there you go. And it's like, well, there's a little bit more to it than that.
Not really.
And it seems simple from the outside.
Yeah, but it's not.
but it's not. And so I think that's for anything. And a lot of people, because they're entrepreneurs and have been successful, think, well, heck, you know, I got a business. I built the business. Of course I can go sell. And of course, there's a lot of people saying, yeah, I'd love to buy your business. Just like there's a lot of people saying, well, I want to eat a meal.
Sure.
But that's a long way from, you know, making that work. And so I think it's very important that you have people around you that you can trust that help you understand what you have, what if you were to go to market, what the outcome would likely be, and is it the right time? And yeah. And timing's a function of many things.
Sure.
Most people think it's all about me. Well, I'm 65 and I had enough, so it's the right time. Well,
yeah.
Your market may be at the worst time. Your business.
You should have sold it 5 years ago, right. Or let's wait for 3 years.
And that's why if you have a good advisor and they're walking alongside you, which I just want to make this note here. And again, this isn't a commercial for founders. It's just a reality.
It's okay. It can be a commercial.
No, but I mean, the reality is if you have a good business and a growing business, most good investment bankers or M&A advisors like founders, and we're one of them, are willing to come alongside you and really for no charge. Like, now, again, if you want us to go do some big, heavy lift, but if you just want us to come in, assess your business, give you an idea where you stack up, and help you think about exit, timing, what you need to do, most good investment bankers will do that.
Yeah.
And they'll do it, and they won't charge you, but what they're doing is they're building trust and relationships.
Sure.
So when you are ready to go, they're going to be your first call, and there's a trust there. And so, you know, it's only smart for people building companies who want to sell to have these kind of relationships. And,
absolutely.
And it's a lot of what we do, and I think differentiates us, is we want to get – a lot of investment bankers want to show up when they're ready to sell, like I'm ready to go to market, and they say, yeah, let's go. But who are the ones that are going to show up 3, 4, 5, 6 years before and help you get prepared, you know, for that and invest that time in?